Grace, the Amy Santiago of Royal Bloggers.
And I'm Jessica, the Dorothy Sporanath of Royal Bloggers.
And we'd like to welcome you to On Air, the podcast where two cynical Brits discuss the latest royal news and the truth behind the stories.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the On Air podcast. 2 weeks in a row. Hasn't happened for a while.
It's quite miraculous.
It really is. It has been a slightly quiet week. And initially, we started thinking about something Halloween related that we could do, because this will be coming out around Halloween. We're recording on the 29th of October. But then we realized that this episode will come out on the 2nd of November, which is a few days before another big celebration that we have in the UK, Bonfire Night, also known as Guy Fawkes Night, or Fireworks Night. There's lots of different names for it. So we decided that we would cover that instead, because it has a very royal history. It's a big annual celebration that happens every year in the UK. It's kind of like Halloween in that it's not a public holiday, but it is sort of, you know, a cultural institution that we all celebrate every year. And yes, it has a very royal history.
I do think it was quite fun. We were like, yeah, nothing's happened this week. What happened 500 years ago?
I should also say before we kick off that we do learn about this in primary school, this, or I did anyway, I assume you
Yeah,
did.
I did.
Yeah. We learn about this in primary school in the UK, and so I did know the basic details of it, but obviously through doing this podcast episode, I had to go and like research some of the stuff in more detail. And I should just warn people that some of the information that I have in this came from a children's video that was narrated by a Cockney cartoon rat. So... I don't know how accurate the cartoon rat is, but hopefully there's nothing that's too glaringly incorrect.
If we have a real discrepancy, we'll just have to see like whether the rat
blame the rat. Blame the rat was really like the motto of that period of time as well, because everyone was dropping with plague and whatnot. Yeah. So
blame the rat. That really is it. The whole thing.
You know, this event happened in the 17th century, but to understand it, we have to go even further back, I think. So my notes start with Henry VIII. I think I've tried to keep this quite top level, because we could go into massive detail, but that's probably an episode for another day. But I think most people know the basic outline of Henry VIII's sort of religious issues. For a long time, everyone was Catholic. And then there was this growing movement called the Reformation, which was sprouting up in countries across Europe, which was essentially challenging the supremacy of the Catholic Church and trying to put something else in its place. And in England, there was a movement towards Reformation anyway, but then it kind of became very successful and won out when Henry VIII decided that he wanted to break away from the Catholic Church and form the Church of England, which would be Protestant. Because he wanted to be able to have full control, he appointed himself as the head of that church, and they would allow him to divorce. The famous, you know, there's a famous story, everyone knows this, I think, who's listening to this.
Yes.
This was a very radical shift. You know, everyone had been Catholic for an incredibly long time. Henry VIII had been a very dedicated Catholic for a very long time, until suddenly he was like, actually, it'll benefit me more if I'm not, so I'm not going to be. But because of this being quite a radical change, to impose the authority of the new church, he did things like dissolving the monasteries, Catholic monasteries, seizing their assets for the crown. He had a lot of his opponents executed, anyone who wouldn't sort of swear allegiance to him. And that pattern kind of continued down the generations with his children.
His children from Anne Boleyn onwards, so Elizabeth and Edward, were both raised Protestant, obviously. Mm-hmm. Considering, you know, their dad was the king and the head of the Church of England. When he did get to sort of towards the end of his life, and he had three heirs, and you had a young boy, a slightly older girl, and a much older girl who was Catholic, the discussion went from being like, we need a male heir, to we need a Protestant male heir. Yeah. Just like to add a bit more pizzazz into succession dramas, as we do.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, so when Henry VIII died, his son Edward took on the throne, and as he said, he'd been raised as a Protestant, so he kept Protestantism. Then when he died, there was Lady Jane Grey, but we won't get into that because that's a whole different thing.
That's a whole episode.
That's a whole episode in itself. Then it eventually went back to his eldest sister, Mary, who'd been raised Catholic. So then she reversed everything, and she started executing Protestants instead. And then Mary died, And then Elizabeth came onto the throne, and she'd been raised as a Protestant. So she reversed everything that Mary had done, and she started executing Catholics again. I just think, like, must have been really stressful. I mean, there were lots of reasons why it was stressful in the 16th century, but it must have been very stressful to know, like, every 5 years you're going to have to change your religion because you don't want to get murdered.
You know, I was trying to figure out like the actual time span from like Henry VIII coming to the throne as a Catholic to Elizabeth I dying in like 1603, and it's like just under 100 years. Like that's such a busy period of time to go through not only that many monarchs but that many religions. It's just like swapping backwards and forwards. Yeah, and it wasn't, you know, and they were very aggressive with it, apart from Edward, who was just kind of like, I want everyone to be Protestant and I will put in lots of rules about it. And other people did the bossing around for him. Mary and Elizabeth were both more like, I will murder anyone who is not the same religion as me, just to make a point.
Elizabeth I provided some level of stability, even though she was still very, bloodthirsty and liked to kill a lot of Catholics. She was reigned for a very long time and was very famously the Virgin Queen, never married, never had any children. But also, I think because she was a woman, even at the time, their understanding of biology was that they knew quite a while before she died that she wasn't going to have any children. She wasn't going to have an heir of, that she had given birth to. So they actually had quite a long time to prepare for who should be the heir to the throne when she passed away. That's where we get to the Scottish contingent.
Yeah, there was lots of sort of discussion going on because you, I think, because there'd been so much switching backwards and forwards in our religion, the Protestants had their choices and the Catholics had their choices. But in the end, the Protestants won out by picking the most Catholic Protestant they could find, who happened to be the King of Scotland at the same time.
So, Mary Stuart, who's Mary Queen of Scots, as most people know her, was a Catholic. She believed that she should take over when Queen Elizabeth died and fought very hard for that. Again, that's another episode in itself. It's very interesting. But she was facing a lot of opposition in her own country because most of the Scottish nobility were Protestants. And so she was, for various reasons, forced to abdicate in 1567. And her son, who was still an infant, James, he took over and became King James VI of Scotland. Mary was eventually locked up in England and then eventually executed by on, sort of on the orders of Queen Elizabeth I. And so that kind of cleared the way and meant that James was brought up by mostly powerful Protestant aristocrats in Scotland, also with kind of Elizabeth in the background, sort of regularly checking in to make sure things were going as planned because she wanted a Protestant to take over after her. So I think for the Protestant elite in England, knowing Elizabeth was going to die eventually with no children, they saw James as a way to both secure the Protestant faith in England, by having a Protestant monarch, and also to unite Scotland and England, because this is something that for lots of generations the English monarch had been trying to do. But anyway, it did mean that in 1603, when Elizabeth finally popped her clogs, he became James the First of England. So James the Sixth of Scotland and James the First of England, same guy.
Even going all the way back to Henry the Seventh, the Tudors had been really bad at having heirs. Like Henry the Seventh had Prince Arthur, who died, so it went to Henry. Henry the Eighth had two daughters, so then he kept waiting for a son. Or Edward, Lady Jane Grey, Mary, and Elizabeth didn't have any children. So having a Protestant distant cousin was helpful, but having a Protestant distant cousin who was married and had three children already was even more helpful because they could just sort of shuffle them into the throne.
So he was considered to be the best choice. And so, yeah, in the end, he took over, went to England, and was much, much preferred England to Scotland. But that's again another episode about how much I don't like James. It's very easy to look at that period of time with our own modern lens on it, especially as British people, where even though we don't have an official separation of church and state, we are a very secular society. Religion doesn't really have much of an impact on the way we view things on a day-to-day basis. It was very different back then in the faith of the monarch was about more than just what they believed and when they went to church. Like Charles is a head of the Church of England. He's obviously a Protestant, I'm not. I mean, I was raised in the Church of England, but I'm an atheist, so it doesn't really matter to me what, I don't have to change anything about the way I live my life because of the religion of the monarch. It was very, very different in that period of time. People had very real reasons to believe that if their religion didn't match up with the religion of the monarch, their life would be at risk. There were things that Elizabeth had introduced, like making it compulsory that people go to church and go to church, Protestant church services in particular, which meant that, it was very difficult for Catholics to practice their faith even in private. They had to publicly hold up an image of themselves as being Protestant. So I think, nowadays it can seem a little bit like, oh, well, it's just if you're Protestant or Catholic, it doesn't matter. But in that period of time, it had a very real impact on people's lives. And so when James took over the throne as this new person who wasn't that well known to a lot of the English, there was a lot of expectation from both sides of the religious landscape on what he would do.
And I think the way Protestantism, the way being a
Protestantism.
Church of England person
Anglican, say
and a
Anglican.
Catholic, Anglican, that's the word. And also the way you sort of practiced as an Anglican or a Catholic today is far more similar than it was in the 1600s, 1500s, because I don't want to say Catholics are very extra, but they are. I feel like I can say that. I was very much raised Catholic, and I learned about all my James the First and Bonfire Night knowledge, apart from all the new stuff I learned this time, was in a Catholic school. So it was
Oh,
very fun
that's
to read about it again.
interesting. Yeah. We'll talk about that later.
It's my Catholic lens. But I think I remember being younger and being at school and being like, but it's like the same thing. They just have less fancy churches, so I don't see the difference. But then they were like, no, like back in the day, the way they were practiced was fundamentally different. And I think Catholicism is a lot more elaborate, and show-offiness is not the right word, but it's sort of ostentatious. Whereas Anglican, even if you look at like Anglican churches, are a lot more sort of sedate. But it went against everything from like the services to the prayers to the belief system. And I think that's kind of the drastic difference has really sort of narrowed over the years. And I think it's really hard to look back in the 1500s and be like, oh, it would have, you couldn't just have pretended to be a Protestant and actually been a Catholic. It was really hard. You had to kind of commit or hide it.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of things about when I remember when I was younger reading about like people who refused to recant their Catholicism and they were given the opportunity and they were like, we won't burn you at the stake or cut off your head if you choose to just say you're not a Catholic anymore. And they refused. And I was always like, well, that's stupid. But I think in that period of time, like as I said, everybody had to go to church by law. So if you had to do something by law, I think it would be quite important to you how what you were actually being asked to do, like does it match up with who you are as a person? And a lot of these things are about like, do they believe that the bread and the wine actually become transubstantiation? Do they actually become the body of Jesus? It's a lot of like theoretical arguments and theological arguments that to me, even when I was going to church, I didn't really think about them ever at all. To modern sensibilities, it might sound strange, but it was a hugely influential part of their day-to-day lives. And everybody was part of a religion. And so it was kind of like it was an attack on somebody's identity rather than being an attack on just what they happened to believe. It was about their way of practicing, their way of life, their belief systems. The way that religion was viewed at the time is just very, very different to the way that it is viewed, at least in the UK, today. And this was sort of, for a lot of people, a kind of battle for their existence, not just. I would quite like it if the monarch had the same religion as me. This was like, if I don't do this, I think I might die. It's interesting, I think, to think about how the Catholics responded to James the First, James the Sixth, whatever you want to call him, coming to the throne. I think there was a hope amongst some English Catholics that he might allow for some more religious tolerance, or amongst some of the more optimistic, there was even hopes that he might convert because his mother had been a very passionate Catholic, and also his wife was a Catholic before she married him. And so there was a lot of hope from a lot of people that this would be kind of a new era for them and that he would change things from how Elizabeth had done them.
Initially, he was very kind of laid back about the whole religion thing. Like, he was a Protestant, but obviously he had very Catholic family members. You know, he'd been his, like you mentioned, his mother, his wife, and he had sort of Catholic advisors, and he wasn't the kind of scorched earth approach that Elizabeth had had to Catholics. But also he didn't particularly make anything
No.
better. He just kind of carried on with everything that had happened before without just not, it wasn't his torture, it was England's torture. So it's fine.
We do know that there were things that James had initially favored relaxing, like for example, the law that required everybody to go to Protestant church services, basically. He had initially been in favor of relaxing those rules to kind of allow for people to go to Catholic church services as well, but then he ended up keeping them because when they relaxed the rules, they found that the Protestants weren't going to church either. Yeah, so I think, that he decided to keep that rule after initially being a bit, in favor of relaxing it, but it wasn't actually necessarily something that was targeted at Catholics. It was also because as soon as they were like, you don't have to go to church, no one went to church. They're like, oh no, that's not what we meant. So yeah, he wasn't a Catholic sympathizer as such, but he also wasn't Queen Elizabeth initially. Despite the fact that he was very early on in his reign, he hadn't really had much time to do anything because he took like a billion months to travel down to England. He went on a bit of a tour, a very leisurely pace as he went down. But a lot of Catholics weren't willing to take the risk because he was a Protestant. And so within the first year of his reign, multiple plots against him were hatched. I love a good plot.
I know. And I love the names of them. I love the fact that the one called the main plot is very much not the main plot. It's
Yeah.
the least successful of them all. But it's great fun reading them.
Yeah, well, I think so the two main plots that we will get into, one is called the main plot and one is called the by plot. And I'm just going to say those are terrible names. Nowadays, we have this weird thing where if you read British newspapers, you might know about it, but it seems like all of our political plots these days are named after food, particularly like whatever food the politicians were eating at the time. And I've been obsessed with this for a little while, so I've been gathering them. But we've had like the pork pie putsch, the pizza plot, Baltygate, and my personal favorite, the barbecue boys. If the Catholic, rebels against King James had called themselves the barbecue boys, I would have given them anything they wanted.
Be like, go for it. Yeah, kidnap the king. Oh
Anyways,
gosh.
that's not relevant at all. I just wanted to say.
So the kind of first of the two plots was the by plot. Don't know why they called it that at all.
Yeah, everything I read that was like, oh, it's called the bi plot because it was a subplot of the main plot. And I was like, yeah, but what's bi got to do with it? That doesn't explain anything.
It's irrelevant. Yeah, we'll start with the by plot because that kind of kicked off first in a way. And essentially, it boiled down to two priests called William Watson and William Clark, who wanted to kidnap the king and for kill him or force him to become a Catholic. So obviously, it was a lot more detailed than that. It wasn't just two priests having a nice idea and going like, "Yeah, we could do that, easy peasy." And it had been sort of discussed amongst higher level Catholics and a particular selection of priests called Jesuit priests who are like very dedicated, you know, Jesuit is Jesus, obviously. So it's the like hardcore priests, the upper class of English Catholics. Were like, right, this is what we're going to do. You two priests, William and William, you're going to go and kidnap James, and then we can either kill him and get our own king, or we'll just make someone else be the king, or we can just force him to become a Catholic because that's really easy to do. That's been proven with all of these recent changes. However, at the last minute, some of these priests got cold feet and told the king what they were going to do, which on one hand is really interesting because it shows that he was close enough to Catholics that he was having one-on-one conversations with them.
Yeah.
They were having chats. But obviously that did mean the plan got foiled by Catholics. It wasn't an external force. This was a sort of inner mistake. By this point, William, the two priests knew they'd been rumbled, so they did not try and kidnap him on his coronation day. they were still kind of discussing about it. And then on the 5th of August, so just over 2 weeks after the coronation, they arrested William Watson, who then confessed 5 days later after a short period of torture. And then a few days later, they then caught and arrested William Clark. While this plot was being investigated, they found another plot with other Catholics. The main plot was also going on. So in July, so just before the coronation, this sort of secondary plot had kicked into place with a bunch of very famous Tudors, including Lord Cobham, Lord Grey de Wilton, Griffin Markham, and Sir Walter Raleigh, who was a name I was not expecting to see at any
Yeah,
point in his
careful.
life. I was like, oh, the potato man.
Potato man. I'm sure he'd love that. That's his legacy.
Anyway, the potato man. So they were like, okay, new plan. We're also going to get rid of James. We'll kidnap him. But we've got an idea. We're going to replace him with Arabella Stuart, who we all wanted in the first place. She's more Catholic. She's a Catholic, unlike James, but she's also still got those kind of regal links. She's a family member. Obviously, when the previous priests had told James what had happened, James's investigators were like, right, we need to look into this. And they very quickly rumbled this other plot. Which also probably wasn't helped by the fact that they all kept going to Spain to try and get King Philip III of Spain to fund them in this assassination attempt. And poor King Philip III of Spain comes up quite a bit in this episode with people trying to get money from him and him just being like, no, I am just trying to live. No, I'm not going to fund you to assassinate the king. I'm not doing it. So I'm just living my life. But essentially, the plot was discovered. They were all arrested. As a result of this, and no one would have known by the time people were being executed and pardoned, but when the archpriest George Blackwell went to James I and went, right, we're going to try and kidnap you, sorry. James then was like, okay, new plan, we're getting rid of any member of Catholic clergy in the UK. And he started to write these new laws, the first kind of new anti-Catholic legislation of the era, which ended up sort of kickstarting the next leg of the campaign.
I'm not surprised that this plot was foiled because they were really stupid. When you read about it, basically they went round to a lot of really just random Catholics and were like, "Hey, so do you want to kill the king? He hasn't actually made it to London yet or done anything whatsoever. But we think he might not be very nice to Catholics. So do you want to kill him for us?" And they were like, "Well, no." So of course everybody found out. But I also think, yeah, as you say, in response to this, any possibility that James might have ended up being sympathetic to Catholics ended because they tried to kill him and he'd only been on the throne for a few months. He hadn't even got to London yet. And yeah, he ordered the expulsion of all the Jesuit priests, and he started to basically, yeah, reinforce a lot of Elizabeth's policy. So it was became clear that, the hopes that people might have had for James when he came to the throne, that, some people thought maybe he'll change things for us as Catholics in this country, very quickly through this plot ended up becoming kind of, a line was drawn in the sand. He wasn't going to help them out anymore.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was quite telling that his plan was like, yeah, they've all got to leave. He was like, exile, that'll do. He didn't go straight for the murder. And I think throughout his reign, in fact, he always went for the exile over murder, but only because he thought it was worse. He was like, yeah, you've got to live in a foreign place. I'm like, so that's significantly worse than dying.
I know it's like nowadays I'm just like I really wish that we hadn't had Brexit so that I could more easily go and work in Europe. And in those days it was like the worst thing that could ever happen is that you're sent to Europe. Yeah, so that's kind of the background. This was all happening in sort of 1603-ish when he took the throne. So that kind of nicely leads us, I think, into what we're actually talking about, which is the gunpowder plot, which is part of what we celebrate, I guess, every single year. So the most famous person in the gunpowder plot was Guy Fawkes, who we'll talk about later, but he actually wasn't involved in the beginning. The ringleader of the gunpowder plot was a guy called Robert Catesby, who was a Catholic nobleman. And in 1604, he gathered together a gang of people With this idea that he would blow up the Houses of Parliament, the Palace of Westminster, when the King was visiting for the state opening of Parliament. And so the King, his young heir who was expected to be with him, they would both be killed. The government would be killed. And the idea was that in the sort of vacuum that would be created, the Catholics could step in and they could build up England again as a Catholic country with a puppet queen, the Princess Elizabeth, who was James's daughter. So it wasn't like, they were still like, well, we still want a monarch. We still want somebody within his lineage. But she's, I think she was like 7 years old, 8 years old, or something. So we can control her as a puppet queen. But I think it's quite interesting because whenever, as we said earlier, like whenever you think about like plotters, you think about these like Machiavellian, really smart guys. You think of it as like, what I do anyway, like a war room kind of environment of like how they're plotting things out. But there were a couple of token priests who were in this group at the beginning. But everybody else, except from one guy, was related to Catesby. So it was basically like he was just like, well, I'll just invite my cousins and my brother-in-law and my brother and all these people to come into a room with me. And we'll, it was just a bunch of guys hanging out, being like, wouldn't it be great if we could blow up the government? It was really quite, you think of it as being like these people who were brought together by similar circumstances, but it was just a bunch of his relatives and a couple of token priests, and they had no real concrete plan at all. So it really was quite shambolic from the beginning.
Yeah, and I think if you look at like the timing, the King's sort of anti-Catholic legislation was published on the 22nd of February, and the earliest time we have any kind of record of Catesby getting a sort of gang together was end of February 2004. Not then, 1604. So it was clearly the, you know, like when a politician makes a bad decision and people are like, right, that's it, we're voting them out, next election, and then by the time next election comes around, they've forgotten about it. Except in this case, it was the King being like, right, that's it, Jesuits, you're out. And they were like, okay, clearly the next logical step is for us to blow up the Houses of Parliament. Who's in,
Clearly.
guys? And they were like, yeah, sure, sounds fun. We've got nothing else to do. We're rich men. There is literally nothing we do.
I think this is where Guy Fawkes enters the chat.
Yes, he does. Because obviously, these rich men had never done blowing up Parliament before or blowing up anything. So they needed a gunpowder expert, which is always great fun when you look at the pictures and they're all labeled like Catesby's brother, Catesby's friend, Catesby's slave, Catesby's servant, Catesby's cousin, gunpowder man. There he is.
That's an interesting superhero from Marvel to create, Gunpowder Man. I mean, Guy Fawkes wasn't the leader, it was Robert Catesby, but he is definitely the most famous, and he is also probably the most interesting of the gang.
Yeah, I became a bit obsessed with Guy Fawkes during my research.
Take us through his life story. This is your life, Guy Fawkes.
This is Guy Fawkes. So, Mr. Guy Fawkes, who was born as Guy Fawkes, that's his name his mother gave him, was born in York in 1570 in April to in a little Protestant family. So his paternal family were very, very Protestant. They were Protestant vicars, they were Protestant judges, they were Protestant school teachers. And his mother had married in and converted to Protestantism. And he grew up the first 9 years of his life as a Protestant child. He would have gone to Protestant schools, gone to Protestant churches. And obviously, this is 1570, so it is in the middle of Elizabeth I's reign. But his mother, Edith, had been born to a Catholic family. Her family had grown up Catholic. She'd grown up Catholic. And then in 1579, so 9 years after Guy was born, his father, Edward, died. And his mother remarried someone called Dionys Bainbridge, also known as Dennis, which is what I will be calling him, who was an out-and-out Catholic, which is a very brave thing to be in 1579, the middle of Elizabeth I's reign. And the family then converted to Catholicism. And he was also surrounded by them in lots of different ways. So he attended St. Peter's School in York, which became famous around the time Guy Fawkes was there. Not because of Guy Fawkes, but because one, the head teacher was a Catholic and was secretly disseminating Catholic beliefs to the children. And one of the governors was a Catholic and was trying to steer the school in a very Catholic direction. And his maternal relatives were harbouring Jesuit priests, so they were kind of deep in the underground of Catholicism. Guy was the eldest son of his family, so he inherited the Protestant and Catholic money from his dead father. And in 1591, so he would have been 21, he sold his land, his home, and he decided that as a Catholic and a young man, he was very passionate about this and he was going to go and help Spain fight the Netherlands in the 8 Years' War that was happening over in Spain and the Netherlands. And he also went into France around the same time and helped them out a few years later because the whole of Europe was having their Reformation at this time. Actually, if you kind of oddly, when you consider we speak the whole like last God knows how long it's been talking about how many people were killed, the UK's sort of turn to Anglicanism went fairly smoothly compared to everywhere else, which had like a major disastrous war. But anyway, so he was off doing things. And in 1603, there was a new king. He was like, ah, brilliant. You know what? This would be a great time to do. Let's talk to King Philip III and see if he can help us. Philip III, who was clearly just trying to run a country that's at war right now, was like, would you all stop bothering me about this new king who's not even done anything? I'm not giving any money, guy. But this is his kind of like alter ego. He rebranded himself as Guido Fawkes, like his cool Italian name. He went through a whole stage of denouncing Scotland at this point. He was like, yeah, Scotland. That's what he, when he went to Philip III, he wasn't like, I need to do this to get rid of the Catholics. He's like, I need to do this because he's a Scottish king, and I'm just not okay with that.
I didn't know all of this about Guy Fawkes until I did the research for this episode. I was like, you know what? Maybe I don't really like you.
He'd been having his little, he'd been a Protestant. He was now a fully fledged Catholic. He was a Catholic soldier, and he was almost acting like a mercenary for hire. He was going around Europe fighting for Catholic countries in their various wars. And he was, during this, becoming very good at his job. He went up the ranks very quickly because he was very good at explosives, which may come up later. But yeah, essentially, he very much on his own had been like, yeah, we need our own Catholic monarch. But when the King of Spain had been like, I'm not giving you money to do that, he'd kind of been like, fair enough. I'm just gonna sort of chill, fight, kill some Protestants. Blow some things up. No big plans. Just having this nice casual time. And then some people decide to come and interrupt his time on holiday.
He had a very fateful meeting with a guy called Thomas Winter, who was a member of Catesby's crew over in England, and he was also in Europe scouting for support from Spain.
Poor Philip III just living his best life.
Just leave me alone, guys. Got a lot on my plate. I'm really stressed. I do not need this. So Thomas Winter was roundly, he was very, everyone was very polite to him, but they were like, no, we're not giving you money to blow up the Houses of Parliament, you moron. So he went away. And I don't really, the details, I couldn't really find much about the details of like how they actually bumped into each other. Like, was it just, like a meet cute in a rom-com?
I mean, I think he, Thomas Winter, met with Guy Fawkes's like mentor
Right, okay,
and
that would
was
make
like, do
sense.
you know anyone that would be really good? Because his mentor would have been a rich lord as well. Like, do you know anyone that would be really helpful in blowing up Parliament? And he was like, ah, oh, I've got two great ideas. Christopher Wright, who happens to be the brother of someone already involved, and this other guy, Guido.
He's the most famous person from this plot for reasons that we'll get to in a minute. Even though he wasn't like the ringleader of it, but I do also think I read a lot of articles that are like he was just a tiny little part of the plot, and I'm like, he wasn't really. He was actually quite important to it, and I think he's an interesting figure because he was very different from all of the rest of them. So everybody else who was in the gang, except from those two random, the couple of random priests that they got involved, they were all Catholic, obviously, but they were nobility. They were aristocrats. They had an idea, but none of them had really used gunpowder, which was actually quite a new tool of warfare comparatively. Like swords have been around forever, but gunpowder was quite a new thing. And then this kind of passionately Catholic guy who is a tough military man with experience with gunpowder. He's been away from England for like a decade, so nobody knows who he is. He won't arouse any suspicion. He's a mercenary, so he's essentially his job is to hire himself out for dangerous and potentially lethal missions. He just kind of fell into their lap and was like the missing piece of the puzzle. The person who actually could do the plot, had kind of just fallen into their lap.
It's one of those things where you either read like pro Guy Fawkes articles where they're like, he's innocent and he was manipulated by these wealthy people, or you read like anti Guy Fawkes who are like, no, he is the evil genius. But it's more like he was just like the key part in a machine that other people were putting together. Like, it could not have happened at all without Guy Fawkes or another person who did Guy Fawkes' job. But also, it wouldn't have happened because of him, because he wouldn't have had the idea himself. He wasn't the ideas man, he was the muscle.
But I do think he's interesting because he is just kind of he wasn't poor or anything like that. He inherited an estate, you know. He'd had family members who'd been like Lord Mayors and things. So there was it actually kind of reminded me a little bit of the Middleton family. Not in that there are any, you know, similarities at all, really, except from I'm just using it as a reference point because most people don't understand class and all that kind of stuff in the UK because it's very complicated. But they kind of come from a background of like they're not aristocrats, but they have some money and they do all right, kind of. So he wasn't like destitute peasant rising up against a totalitarian state, but he also wasn't like everybody else in that gang. So yeah, what was the plot at first?
Turn
So
my page over.
it's brilliant. So once they've got Guy Fawkes, you know, Thomas Winter came back, Guy Fawkes was with him. They had the guy that they needed to actually do the blowing up. Everything was great. So they started actually thinking about, okay, well, what are we actually going to do? And they knew they couldn't get into the building itself because of all of the security. Like they couldn't have just walked in through the front door during the state opening of Parliament and blown up the building. So their first plan was that they would rent a house nearby and that they would dig a tunnel. And they quickly, although, well, some of this is disputed. Some of people think this is like propaganda or it was fabricated by government and so on to make the plotters look more stupid than they were. But I have read that they quickly realized like the walls are too thick for them to get through into the Houses of Parliament. And also the tunnel that they were digging started to flood because it's right by the River Thames. It's so Monty Python. I love it.
It's also like, I mean, I've met men, and it's definitely the kind of thing a man would do is to be like, you know what, that's how we're getting, we'll just dig a big tunnel, that's easy.
Of
Like,
course.
no. So that's why it's very hard to dig tunnels, where they collapse all the time.
Yeah, well, gotta love it. So yeah, they quickly realized that that was not going to work in their favor. And then they had a couple of things that happened that kind of gave them a bit of a break.
Parliament adjourned on the 7th of July. It was due to come back in February. They postponed it to the 3rd of October because of the plague on the 24th of December. And then by the time it got to July, they were like, yeah, we're not going to make October either. So they delayed it again to the 5th of November. Important day, make them up again. So yeah, they kept delaying things because there were loads of rats everywhere biting people, giving plague, you know, as they do.
Unsurprisingly, the Cockney cartoon rat in the video that I watched didn't mention that, which I think is a bit of, you know, erasure of history to kind of make themselves look good. But, you know, whatever. Yeah, so they had this break of like they had more time essentially to be able to work on their plan. If it had gone ahead when it was supposed to initially, they might not have had enough time to plan anything. The other thing is that they found out that they could rent a cellar room that was underneath the House of Lords, which would become available. I think it was owned by the same people who'd owned the little house that they'd rented and tried to dig the tunnel from. And so one of the aristocrats who was part of the gang, who was sort of, he was a Catholic, he was known to be a Catholic, but he was an aristocrat, so he was relatively well connected and allowed to do things without raising alarm bells. He rented this cellar that was right underneath the Houses of Parliament, and off Fawkes went to try and get some gunpowder.
I love it. This aristocrat was called Thomas Percy, and like half of these people are called Tom. Honestly, get different names.
Thomas William, like, be more like Guy.
Yeah, Guy Fawkes stands out because he's got the best name,
Yeah.
other than Tom, Kit, Rob. Anyway,
Yeah.
Mr. Percy was this aristocrat, and he'd become one of like the king's bodyguards, but like a distant one. And then my favorite thing about this entire story was that Guy Fawkes, who was kind of incognito because no one had seen him for 15 years at this point, was like, yeah, I'll just be your servant, it's fine. And then he came up with a fake name, which was John Johnson.
So I mentioned this later on when they discovered him, but it's just that's one of my favorite details of the story as well. It's like the worst fake name I think that he might have actually had a servant called John Johnson, and that's where it came from. But it does just sound like somebody sort of caught you doing something wrong, and they're like, "What's your name?" And you're like, "John Johnson."
Yeah, so
That's
this is you're
ridiculous.
gonna like John what? Johnson.
Yeah, it's not sort of the sort of sophistication of like a Kaiser Soze. I don't know if you've seen The Usual Suspects. This is just not like that at all. I mean, maybe John Johnson was a really common name at the time, and it's just funny to us now, but it's one of my favorite details too.
Especially because he's got the coolest name. Like the rest of them are all called like Tom and Rob and
Yeah.
Tom and John and
William.
William. Yeah, they've got the most boring names. And he's got Guy Fawkes, and he's like, "Yeah, I need a boring name of yours, John."
John Johnson. Yeah, it's brilliant. Yeah, so he went off to get some gunpowder from Europe, and they moved 36 barrels in total into the new cellar, hidden behind some firewood. Also, something that I didn't know was that they added apparently hundreds of metal bars to the gunpowder barrels. The idea was that this would cause maximum casualties. Because it was metal, it wouldn't just be an explosion, it would be metal that would be ripping through.
It's kind of funny to think about it now. And people made lots of jokes about it. But he was, they were very much planning to murder every single member of parliament, the king, the queen, the future King Charles I, who
Was
was
still a
very
child.
young at the time.
Yeah.
He was younger than his sister, so he was only about 5 or 6. He was very young. Plus any just normal average people who worked there and people in nearby houses. Like they were just gonna take him out. Which I know, you know, on one hand for them it's very much for the greater good, but on the other hand there was no consideration for the many innocent people who would have died, including Catholics, because I'm sure Catholics lived or would have been walking nearby at various points.
Yeah, definitely. And both of those points come up later in my notes as well. I think you're completely right. And Fawkes was left to guard all of the gunpowder because he was the only guy who knew anything about the gunpowder. The plan was that eventually, when the time came, he would set fire to it and then he would kind of escape. And the rest of the gang went up to the Midlands. And the idea was that after the explosion, they would raise up the forces of the Midlands, you know, in revolt, and would capture Princess Elizabeth, who was staying there at the time, and she was the person that they were going to install as the puppet queen. She was only a little girl. The plan was that he would then go to Europe and be like, "Sorry, guys, we know we killed the king, but we did it because he wasn't very nice to Catholics, and you guys are Catholics, so you should probably understand that."
Yeah, I do like the fact that like between like March 2005 and November when they were gonna like
1605.
yeah 1605 between March 1605 between March 1605 and November 1605 when they were gonna you know bomb everything, they all just kind of like had nothing to do for a few months, so they just kind of like Guy Fawkes went to Europe on holiday, and we thought he was on holiday, but it sounds like he was on holiday because we don't know what he did when he was there. You know, some of them were just chatting to priests, being like, so theoretically, if theoretically someone was to theoretically kill the king, would you be okay with that? And everyone was like, I'm kind of suspicious about this,
Yeah.
but not suspicious enough to do anything at this precise moment. So, as with the previous rich men who decided to start a plan to kill the king, they fell into the rubbish trap of telling
Telling
everyone they're
everyone.
planning to kill the
Idiots.
king,
Yeah.
honestly.
Yeah, they did exactly. It's exactly the same thing. Those earlier plots were foiled because they just went around telling everybody, and somebody was like, "Oh, that's not a great idea. Let's not do that. I could get in favor with the king if I tell him," sort of thing. And none of them learned their lessons, so they were all just telling everybody. So as time went on, I think some of the plotters. This is why I was cautious when I was saying earlier about like the some people being concerned, not being concerned about the massive loss of life. There were some within the plotting group who were starting to become really concerned because there were Catholic members of Parliament and Catholic members of the House of Lords. There were people who were going to be in the immediate vicinity who were Catholic. And so even though they were like, "Well, killing Protestants, whatever," they still had enough of a conscience to kind of be like, "I don't know if it's okay that we are trying to achieve our goals of sort of freedom for our people of our faith by killing members of our faith, knowingly killing members of our faith, because we know that they will be in there."
Yeah, I think in many ways, like the many delays of Parliament was incredibly helpful to the plotters because there is no way they would have been ready for the original return February date. They didn't even have the gunpowder at that point. Like they were not ready. However, because they had these like 5 months off, it gave them time away from each other because I think up to that point they'd very much all been on top of each other, riling each other up. And then they all went their separate ways for a couple of months and were like, hang on, what have I just agreed to do? I've just agreed to kill who now?
Well, let's all remember that they were always meeting in pubs.
Yeah, they were drunk. Let's
Yeah,
be
let's
honest.
just say it was a
They were
bunch of
Duck and
guys who
Drake
were,
Inn.
a bunch of guys who were mostly related to each other who got drunk and thought this would be a great idea, and then they went home and they were like, oh no.
And I think also they would have spoken to like prominent Catholics of the day. Like a name that comes up a lot is Henry Garnet, and he comes up quite a bit. He's a priest. And he was like, you can't do that. You can't just kill the king. And I think, you know, going to other Catholics who were prominent and didn't like James the First, and some of them were going, no, that's a stupid idea, is probably not the best for team morale.
Yeah, they don't cover that on The Apprentice. Yes, so this actually ended up being kind of the downfall of the plot. So on the 26th of October, the Catholic peer, Lord Monteagle, that's a good name. Anyway, he was the brother-in-law of one of the plotters because all of these people are related to each other. This is what happened when you've got like six big families and they all just marry each other over and over again. But he was given an anonymous letter by his servant, which the servant had been given in the street by somebody. And this letter said, I'm paraphrasing, but it said, don't go to the opening of Parliament because it will be really bad for you. We don't know for definite, but it probably was, you would imagine, his brother-in-law, who was one of the plotters. It was like, hey, don't go. Lord Monteagle gave the letter to Robert Cecil, who was the kind of the right-hand guy of King James. Cecil decided, well, the king's hunting, so I'll wait until he gets back to show him the letter, which I love.
First of all, James is always hunting. Like anytime
Always
anything's
hunting.
happened, it's like he's on a hunting trip. But when he got back, but I also like the fact he was like, well, they're not planning on doing this till November the 5th, so I've got time. What's the point in upsetting him now? Let's just chill. So, but also like that's what kind of foiled the plan because Guy Fawkes did his sort of final checks on everything, make sure everything's ready on October the 30th, and none of the sort of king's men were kicked into snooping around until November the 1st. So when he's checked to make sure everything was fine, everything was fine. No one was looking. No one was investigating.
Yes, so on the 1st of November, James came back from hunting. Cecil showed him the letter. And you have to remember that James the First or James the Sixth had grown up in Scotland initially and then had moved to England. And he had, throughout the course of his life, ever since he was a little child, experienced multiple plots because I love my country. But my goodness, they could not chill for 5 minutes. They just always kept trying to kill each other and take over. But there was a lot of plotting, and so he'd had multiple attempts on his life. And of course, in the first year of his reign, he'd had the bi plot and the main plot. So he'd already, within the first year of being king, he'd already had two plots against him. So while other people might have gone, oh, it's probably nothing, he took it very seriously. The fact that they waited actually worked in their favours because the plotters had found out by this point that the letter had made its way to Cecil and to King James, presumably. And so they knew, people in government knew about this plan. And so they could have at that point called it off. The plotters had been like, well, there's nothing, nobody's come for us, nobody's searched the vaults. When we last checked on October 30th, everything was fine. So they presumed that the letter had been dismissed as a hoax. And so they decided that they would go ahead with their plans. So actually, waiting until James got back from hunting was one of the things that kind of meant that they were able to capture people in the end. I'm giving away a plot point there, but. So yeah, they waited until the 4th of November to first search the vaults. And they did that. And while searching, they found some firewood and a guy. Calling himself John Johnson, who was obviously Guy Fawkes. And he, when he was questioned, he said that he was there on behalf of his master, Thomas Percy. And that did ring some alarm bells because Percy was a very well-known Catholic. But initially, in that first search, they just found the firewood and a random guy in the cellar. So they kind of left it on it alone.
Yeah, they kind of went home like, okay, that seems highly suspicious, but I mean, why not store your firewood under Parliament the night before the
Yeah.
State of the Parliament? That seems fairly okay.
Can't hurt people with firewood.
Perfectly normal thing to have.
So because it kind of not sat well with people, they decided to order a second search. And so in the early hours of the 5th of November, they found Guy Fawkes again with the firewood, but then they looked under the firewood, and they found a ton of gunpowder, and Fawkes was found to have fuses and matches on him. And so, of course, he was arrested.
He was also wearing a great outfit,
Yes, he
which
was.
is when all of the things like I don't think the outfit could be that important, but like yeah, he's wearing spurs and a cloak, and he's got a watch from Thomas Percy, and he's got a hat on, and I was like, I don't know why it's so important. I love the fact it's in there because it's kind of like a costume, but no, you know, I don't know what anyone else was wearing at any point in the story. None of them. Exactly what Guy Fawkes was wearing when they crowned him under Parliament. I
Robert
love that.
Catesby's fashion hasn't become a thing, has it? Just Guy
Maybe he
Fawkes.
didn't wear enough cloaks
Yeah.
and spurs, if that was what he was wearing.
Oh, I just realized I forgot my joke about Guy Fawkes. So when I was writing out my notes, I was right. It's not even a funny joke, but I just realized I forgot to say it. When I was writing out my notes, I got to the section about Guy Fawkes's life, and I wrote down "Life of Guy," and then that was just what I was writing down, and then I realized it sounds very much like the popular book and film Life of Pi, and I laughed at my own joke for like 2 minutes. And I'm so disappointed in myself that I didn't say Life of Guy. Oh, goodness me.
We'll just call the episode Life of Guy.
To make up for
Summarize.
it. So annoyed at myself. Anyway, there wasn't much left to the Life of Guy. Yeah, so he was taken to the king. He said he was called John Johnson, but there was no hanging about. He was like, "Yeah, I was there to blow you up." Yeah.
Yeah, but he was like, I was there to blow up because I hate Scottish people.
Yes. So, yeah, one of the things he said was his purpose was to blow you Scotch beggars back to your native mountains. Now, Scotch is for people who don't know, unless it's being used to describe like whiskey or an egg or tape. Yeah, Scotch egg, you know. If it's being used to describe a person who is Scottish, it is a derogatory term. And I think there are a lot of people who don't know that. But I don't think at that point in time that it was quite as negative. But within the context of the fact that he really hated the fact that the monarch was Scottish and wanted to blow us back to our native mountains, that's not great. Was taken to the Tower of London, underwent days of torture, some really, really nasty things, which I have written down, but I probably won't say them because, we might get restricted because we're talking about, although the serial killer podcasts are all fine. But yeah, and so he was tortured, and as you would expect, gradually under torture, he began to reveal some of the details of the plot and some of the people who were involved at the pl in the plot.
I like the fact that the room he was tortured in, Tower of London, they named after him. Like,
Yes.
no one else got a room named after them. No one, there's not a Catesby room somewhere.
I can't decide if that's like passive aggressive or if it's because the king liked him. I don't
I just like, they were like, yeah, oh, he's a monster who tried to kill us all, but I quite like him. So we'll call this torture chamber the Guy Fawkes room. What a guy. And there is this really famous image of his signature because the law was at the time, because people couldn't write, that someone else, you dictated a confession and then you signed it, which would have been a really easy way to get false confessions because people also couldn't read. But there's a very famous picture, I assume scanned, of Guy Fawkes' signature from his first confession, and then his final confession. And it's not a nice representation of what he went through in those like 3 days, because it's not a very long period he sort of being tortured for. It's quite a lot he went through.
At the same time this was all going on, the others were still camped up in the Midlands. They were congregating around a place called Holbeck House in Staffordshire. And my favorite part of the story, other than the John Johnson, is that they had some gunpowder there as well, because the plan had been to sort of create a revolution in the Midlands and lead that back to London with little Elizabeth as the puppet queen. But the gunpowder got damp. And so they decided that they would spread the gunpowder out in front of a fire in order to dry it. And of course, a spark came off the fire and set fire to the gunpowder, and they were all burned. One of the articles I was reading about it said they got their explosion after all, which I thought was a really brilliantly passive aggressive way of phrasing it. But it's again that sort of Monty Python quality. Like, you put your gunpowder out to dry in front of a fire, you morons.
I was like, that is the stupid. You can tell they're not the gunpowder experts because it's the stupidest thing I'd ever read. I'm like, mum, come and read this. This is so funny.
Normally, Grace and I don't confer too much about what we've got in our notes. We check that they're the same sort of structure, basically, or that they would work together. But we don't check the details, so it's kind of a surprise and it feels like a real conversation. But I texted Grace last night and I was just like, oh my goodness, this is the best thing ever, because it's so funny.
It's so I just couldn't get over it. It just knocked me out for like 5 minutes. I was like, I can't believe they just put gunpowder in front of a fire. Like, if you wrote that in a story, they'd be like, I just don't think that's very realistic. No one
They'd
would
been
do that.
planning to
So
use
no.
gunpowder to kill a ton of people, and they didn't think, oh, this is quite deadly if it's put near fire.
But honestly, the entire time they wrap in the North, they were just being disastrous. They were being idiots, quite frankly. They had absolutely no genuine plan. They were still planning on kidnapping the princess, which did not happen at any point. Catesby was telling some people, they were like, yeah, okay, so they've caught Guy Fawkes, we can still fight them. And they were telling other people, like, we've already killed the king. They're just hiding it. It was just like the biggest load of nonsense.
Fake news.
Like, honestly, it was a disaster. Like, Catesby was in no way a grand Machiavellian masterminder, and this disastrous, like, 5 days in the Northwest proved it because he was very much the captain of a sinking ship and was desperately trying to hold on.
But yeah, so Guy Fawkes started telling who his conspirators were, what the plan was, where they were. And so, of course, the king's, I think, sheriff arrived with a bunch of people, a bunch of troops, and there was a bit of a shootout. And a lot of people who were there died, including Catesby. And yeah, the rest were captured and taken back to London.
It's really kind of sad because Guy Fawkes cracked on the 7th of, I guess the film he's in cracked, he did crack on the 7th of November, which is when he was like, nope, I'm Guy Fawkes and I was planning on doing it with my friends, but I'm not telling you the names yet. But on the 6th of November, a man called Sir John Popham had already been up in the Northwest and around talking to famous Catholics that had suddenly disappeared and their servants and had already almost identified all of them. Like, he already knew Catesby and Robert Winter and Thomas Winter and the Wright brothers and a whole gang of them, because the servants would be like, oh yeah, we did hear about this,
Yeah.
sorry. They did very much already know exactly what was going on
Yeah.
by
They
this
didn't
time.
need to torture him.
They could have stopped at that point.
Everybody was arrested, taken back, or who hadn't died, and was taken back to London. The trial began in January of 1606 in the same room that they tried to blow up, which I find quite fun.
Big on symbolism in this
Yeah,
era.
they really are, which I appreciate. I'm also big on symbolism. You can find transcripts and things of the trial online, but it's all in Old English, and I have no idea what any of them are saying, really. But basically, the gist of it is they just told everybody what we just told you now, what the plan was, and what happened. It was never going to end in favor of the plotters because this was the early 17th century.
They're like, they were dead. The second Guy Fawkes was arrested, they were all found guilty of high treason on the 27th of January and sentenced to be hanged, drawn, and quartered.
I'd just like to say, hung, drawn, and quartered. So that's a phrase that you hear all the time and happened to loads of people back in the day. That was the standard form of punishment for something like this. I don't think I'd really appreciated what it was. I'd thought you're hung, so you're dead, and then they do some weird stuff to your body. But you're hung until you're just about dead, but you're still alive, and then all of this horrible stuff, which I do have written down, but I don't know if we want to say it. All of that stuff happens to you while you were still alive.
I did know, but only because I was told in primary school. I felt like Catholic schools get away with far too much graphic nonsense sometimes. I distinctly
Oh
remember watching The Passion of Christ in primary
no.
school, and that is an 18-rated, very bloody film. But I remember watching, like, specifically, like, the torture scenes in
Oh
that, and they were like,
gosh.
this is what Jesus went through. Okay. So I would have been maybe 8, and I remember being them being like, "Yeah, so they pull your insides out while you're still alive." And I'd be like,
A lot of people apparently tried to jump off the scaffold while they were being hung so that their neck would break and they would die.
yeah. So they split the assassinations, executions, that's probably my word, across 2 days because there were so many of them. So the minor leagues, the your Digby, your Rob Winter, your Bates, the lower class Bates, and some of a couple of the others were killed on the 30th of January at St. Paul's Churchyard. And then the next day, the 31st of January, 2006, at this point, not 2006, nothing happened in 2006, 1606, Guy Fawkes, Thomas Winter, Robert Wright, and Thomas Keyes were executed in the old Palace Yard in Westminster, in full sight of the exact point they were going to blow up, just to be really dramatic. They left Guy Fawkes for last because he's Guy Fawkes. He was the famous guy. He wore the cool outfit. At least one of them, I'm fairly sure it was Digby from the day before, did definitely jump. And then all the reports like Guy Fawkes maybe kind of jumped or he fell. No one is knows for sure, but they still carried on with all the torture afterwards because they were like, "No, we're making a point here, guys." They went up, exhumed the bodies of Catesby and Thomas Percy and all the other people who died, and decapitated them and took their heads down to London. They just went for it. They were like, "No, we're making a point. We're not just going to leave out anyone. Come on, we're all in this together."
I think I probably breezed too quickly past your point about all the torture and stuff. I find that really interesting about like how you were taught about it. I don't know if that's something you've got later on as well.
I didn't realise until I became a teacher in non-Catholic schools that like I had a very one-sided education in some things. I remember we did The Shining for description, like the book, and they wanted to show us a clip. It was nothing happened. It was like a clip of the hotel, but we had to get like letters of consent from parents because it's an 18 film. And I was like, "You've also shown me The Passion of Christ with no consent from my parents." And it was a lot like more dramatic than just scenes of a hotel.
I think the way that history is taught is something that's full of bias, regardless. You know, in your particular environment, it was let's dwell on the extreme detail of the torture and executions of these people who were Catholics. Whereas in my, when I was growing up, I didn't learn about the Great Fire of London. You were just mentioning, I didn't learn about that at school, but I did learn about all the times the English tried to kill us. And it's taught in very much a way of like, we wanted to be independent and the English kept coming in and trying to kill us. And so we fought back against that. The children in England don't learn about things like the Highland clearances. You know, there is always a lens, and it's sort of like World War II is generally taught as like, we're the good guys and the other guys are the bad guys. And obviously they are bad guys. I'm not saying that, you know, Germany in World War II was great. They were the bad guys, but also like we did some really bad things.
Taking over the World War II lessons to be like, "And this is what England did wrong."
Exactly.
And then, the history subject leads always come in and like, "Grace, that's not on the curriculum. Can't stop me. This is what I just do what I do."
Well, one of the interesting parts about this is the legacy of all of this. Why are we talking about this gunpowder plot? And so I suppose there's the immediate legacy, which was an immediate increase in hostility towards Catholics. So Cecil in particular, who was very anti-Catholic, who's the guy who was the right-hand guy of the king, who just kind of brought the letter to him after he came back from hunting. So he was able to, alongside the king, of course, but he was able to pursue some very restrictive anti-Catholic legislation, to the point that actually one of the articles I was reading said that some people believed that Cecil plotted the entire plot to advance his agenda to crack down on Catholics and sort of take away their rights, which is very like, you know, like 9/11 conspiracy theories about how like it was all George Bush.
Some of these like laws, I had definitely never heard that Catholics were forbidden from voting.
Yeah.
Like, and I know, we didn't have a particularly good democracy pre Civil War. But like, I didn't know that at all. Obviously just imprisoning random Catholics and increasing taxes because they could now, because the PR for the king was so good. Everyone was like, "Oh, poor James, what a lovely, lovely man. Lovely man who foiled a plan single-handedly. What a good man." And I think I read a few things that were like, what happened to the Catholics was significantly worse than it had been, But a lot of compared to what were happening to Catholics in other countries, like in the Netherlands and places like this, it was still fairly lenient, because especially considering the assassination attempt. And a lot of sort of scholars have sort of thought back and said, like, if the plan had worked and people had died, it probably would have been significantly more sort of a far higher death rate. You know, many more Catholics killed, and the anti sort of Catholic sentiment, I think, would have been a lot higher, because the Catholics would have just killed every important person in the country.
I'm not trying to undermine what happened to Catholic people, because given how important faith was, not being able to practice your faith and being expelled from the country and stuff like that's a very serious thing, and I can understand why people were really frustrated. But the goal wasn't like, let's try and create religious tolerance. The goal was, let's just flip it so that we're in charge and we get to kill all the Protestants.
It's really hard to sympathize with this kind of intentional act of murder with no real plan for the aftermath. They didn't have a designated successor apart from the puppet of Princess Elizabeth, who was 9 years old. They didn't really know what these laws were going to be. They didn't know how to run a country. But then, like you mentioned, I always remember being sort of in primary school and being like, why did these people not just say they were Protestant and pretend to be Catholic and like be Catholic in private? But you couldn't. And I think sort of the older I've got, the more I'm like, okay, I understand why now people are so sort of fundamentally determined to remain, to be sort of publicly be the faith they are, because it's such an innate and important thing to so many people. Like, it's really hard to be like, no, you can't do that. And for Catholics in particular, they'd been the only sort of major religion in the UK. And then this new one came along, and it very much was created, like, there wasn't Anglicanism in the 1300s.
We learn a lot about the Reformation in Scotland, obviously in Scottish schools, and it's always characterized. I don't know how accurate this is because, again, it might be this bias we're talking about, but the way that it's taught to us is like the Scottish Reformation was like a natural thing that kind of came from the people, whereas in England it was like the king was like, I just want to be Protestant now and have my own church, and everyone else has to get in line or we'll kill you all. And that doesn't mean people didn't die in Scotland as well, but I think that it was something that was very much suddenly imposed on people.
Yeah, and I think it was very imposed, and then it went back and forward so many times, but so violently each time. The people who planned the gunpowder plot would have grown up, their formative years would have been during the sort of height of the Elizabethan era, where Catholics were being killed in their number far more significantly than Protestants had been in the era before that, or than they were being at that present time with sort of James the First. So I think for them, you know, a lot of these thoughts would have been things that they were, you know, they would have this anger born in their sort of childhood and teenage years and young adulthood, where they were being brute, they and their friends and their communities were being sort of brutally destroyed by essentially a rich woman from London that they didn't know.
Yeah, so the immediate aftermath was a crackdown. It did not work. It actually backfired, much like the earlier plots. The by plot and the main plot had backfired and had led to more, staunchly anti-Catholic views. This really backfired and increased the acceptability of cracking down on people practicing Catholicism. But the royal family wanted to, and the establishment wanted to encourage people to celebrate the occasion. They saw it as a real like PR moment, I guess, of like we can make ourselves look good and we can remind people not to mess with us. And so they, on the first anniversary, on 5th of November 1606, they advised people to celebrate the first anniversary by lighting bonfires, which is such a British way of doing things. Like they weren't successful in lighting something on fire, so except from themselves, when they weren't supposed to. So we're going to rub it in their faces by lighting stuff on fire. But yeah, they sort of encouraged people. People really liked it, and so an Act of Parliament was introduced, which made it an official day of Thanksgiving, which essentially meant you have to celebrate it, which remained in place until 1859.
Right, my first thought was, what on earth was Queen Victoria doing when she took that away?
Yeah,
First
well,
of all.
I don't. I was going to look into what happened and why they repealed it, but I was like, you know what, I can't bother, so I didn't.
Yeah. And she just hate fun. It's not a legal requirement anymore, but It is fundamentally still a thing. And I think I just like how it kind of spiraled so quickly from like light a bonfire to like less than 100 years later, it was like burn people.
Yeah, so over time the tradition evolved. So from like the 1650s, they started adding fireworks as well as bonfires. So from the 1617s onwards, they started making effigies. So largely because this goes back to Guy Fawkes and his snazzy way of dressing, he had a very distinctive look about him that everybody knew that had been in, the cartoons of the time and so on. And so from the 1670s onwards, they started making effigies of Guy Fawkes. And children would go around town presenting their effigies to people, a bit like Halloween, and they would go around door to door and show people their guys, their effigies, and they would ask for a penny for the guy, which is a phrase that a lot of people in the UK will know, which is, yeah, people would give them a penny if they'd made a good effigy. And then they would all go and they would burn the effigy of Guy Fawkes on the bonfire. And so even though the law was repeat was sort of removed in 1859, I think if something happens on an annual basis for 250 years, of course it's going to persist. And so, 2023, when this podcast comes out, it will be a few days before people all over the country gather together with bonfires, and fireworks and celebrate the 5th of November.
It's so like when I was thinking about it, like what we actually do on the 5th of November, like we get bonfires and we get fireworks and we get sparklers and toffee apples and popcorn and hot chocolate and mulled wine and stand in a field with strangers that you don't particularly know and watch a bunch of fireworks. And we're like, yay, ooh, amazing. It's weird and I love it. And it's like I always growing up, bonfire night was by far like my favorite, like odd night. It was better than Halloween. It was better than Easter. Like bar Christmas, it was my favorite night of the year because it was just fun.
I love the idea of you going to your Catholic school in the day and then in the evening going and setting fire to stuff in honor of killing a Catholic. It's very funny. I'm a big fan of it. I think that's because I'm an autumn girl, and I don't mean that in like the Christian girl autumn, like pumpkin spice lattes kind of way. I mean that in like I love when it's cold outside, the leaves on the ground. And it hasn't started snowing yet. It's not icy or anything, but it's just like chilly, and you can go inside and be cozy. And I love the feeling of like the relief of being cozy inside. And I love the rain on the windows. I love autumn. It's my favorite season. To me, Bonfire Night is like the perfect autumn thing because it is about like standing outside in the cold, but with this fire. I love fire. And like the warmth of the fire and the warmth of like if you drink mulled wine or whatever, but you might, I would have just had a cup of tea. I think nowadays, I want to make it clear that it has pretty much lost all of its anti-Catholic sentiment.
The ones I went to were definitely arranged by my Catholic school, my Catholic church. You know, you can use the night to sort of hate on anyone. Like
Is still a thing in lots of places that they burn effigies of popular hate figures of the day. So you would have seen a lot of effigies of Maggie Thatcher, but even like Liz Truss, Rishi Sunak, they've both been on the bonfire in previous years.
you know, when we talk about, oh, you know, the start of the, 2000s has been so busy. Actually, if we go back to the 1600s, from 1605 or 1603 to 1673, they went through the end of Elizabeth I, James I, the Black Death, the Great Fire of London, Charles I, the Civil War, the beheading of a king, the, Charles II, and then another king who then became Catholic again after all that time. Like, what was going on in the 1600s? It was insane. I couldn't have dealt with it. I'm like, right, I'm done. Literally, stop with the news.
It kind of puts like the Oprah interview into a different context.
Yes, like honestly, compared to the 1600s, we're doing fine. We're just chilling.
Yeah, so it's something that has persisted, and we learn about it in school from our own lenses. But we learn about it in school. There's a little rhyme that we all learn, which is "Remember, remember the 5th of November, gunpowder, treason, and plot. I see no reason why gunpowder treason should ever be forgot." And we all learn the little rhyme, and everybody knows it. So you'll hear like "Remember, remember the 5th of November" as a thing. So it's weird because like we do know, everybody knows that. This is celebrating that it was a gunpowder treason plot, and it happened on the 5th of November, and there was Guy Fawkes who was involved in it. So everybody does know, but we just don't really understand. Most people don't know why there was a gunpowder plot. They just think, oh, some guys tried to blow up Parliament and they didn't do it, and so we celebrate that. They don't, I don't, I think there isn't necessarily an understanding about, like, okay, it was because they were Catholic and the king was, you know, they don't know that part of it. But I think it says something very peculiar about the British identity, that while most nations on earth celebrate the success of their revolutions or celebrate some kind of Independence Day, and they uphold these plotters as like folk heroes who helped them secure their independence, the United Kingdom annually celebrates the failure of a revolution, and we mock the main character in that plot.
Britain has like main character syndrome. Like, we have to be different than everyone else. Special different thing we have at the moment is our little weird monarchy with its family drama and little weird things like Bonfire Night and like the fact that, you know, every year after Halloween you get like a tweet where someone will be like, oh, the rest of the world's getting ready for Christmas, but in the UK we've got to go and celebrate burning a Catholic. And you know, we have to make it our own little thing.
It's not that we're not a revolutionary country. It's just that I think that we like the status quo. We like things to remain the same. We like stability. I think it just says something about the British identity that this is what we choose to celebrate, is like the failure of a revolution. We celebrate things staying exactly the same. So I think for a long time, that was, you know, Guy Fawkes was the villain, very clear. In 1841, a novel was written about Guy Fawkes, which romanticized him as this kind of revolutionary folk hero kind of idea, who was a, you know, what's the word they use for swashbuckling? That's the word they use for pirates. He was a swashbuckling military guy. He was tough and he was a hero, and it was covered all of his adventures in Europe. And so it really romanticized him, which is a, you know, throughout the Victorian era, that idea of him as being like an action hero really took off in a lot of the sort of penny dreadfuls, the kind of cheap, mass-produced stories that were very popular amongst the general public.
Guy Fawkes, slightly off topic, but Guy Fawkes really occupies the same place in my head as like Dick Whittington and Robin Hood and King Arthur, like actual folklore figures. You know, made up morality tales. And I occasionally forget he was a real person who really did do something, and he's not just like a. And honestly, the outfit just doesn't help Guy Fawkes. I know you're a fashion icon, but it does not help your case that you were a serious person on a serious mission here. You know, people don't sit there on Bonfire Night, do actually think about Guy Fawkes. They don't think about Robert Catesby because no one knows who he is, and he
No.
didn't have a cool outfit, and no one's
Didn't
doing
have a
a
good
hero.
suit in.
Yeah, he had a boring name, nothing had happened. He'd set himself on fire. Honestly, Guy Fawkes of today is not the Guy Fawkes of 1605. And my favourite quote is from a very famous history, well, very famous a history professor who's very famous for a book he wrote about Guy Fawkes and the Bonfire Night plot, which said that Guy Fawkes was the last man to enter Parliament with honest intentions. And I think, you know, it was written in 2005, so Labour prime, you know, Labour government, we were pre this era of Tories, but post Thatcher, we were Iraqi war era,
New Labour,
you know,
yeah.
it was very specific time to have written this, but it's very much left academia and become a fairly well-known sort of saying and a belief about Guy Fawkes.
This new era, the way that a lot of people will know Guy Fawkes, even if they don't know that they know Guy Fawkes, is because he has been sort of seized hold of as an icon of revolution and rebellion. So a lot of it comes from the anarchist comic book creator Alan Moore, who, along with some other people, did a comic book or graphic novel called V for Vendetta, which was obviously made into a film with Natalie Portman. And they chose the very famous imagery because we all know that we know associate Guy Fawkes with his clothes, as Grace has mentioned several times. She's in love with his outfit.
He had spurs. It's so cool.
But kind of the distinctive facial hair and the cloak and all those sorts of things were co-opted and used as the symbol for a character called V, who was like this revolutionary anarchist who was trying to blow up the Houses of Parliament and trying to encourage people to join together in blowing up the Houses of Parliament. And so they borrowed the iconography of during this sort of era after he'd kind of been reimagined as a folk hero, and used it for this character of V. And then obviously the movie was made, and further down the line, the group, sort of some of the hacktivist groups like Anonymous, also adopted the face, the mask that the character of V had worn as kind of their symbol. And so I think for a lot of people now who are not British and don't know anything about the gunpowder plot or remember the 5th of November or any of this, they will still know the iconic image because of its associations with things like V for Vendetta and Anonymous. So for a lot of people now, Guy Fawkes is seen as a rebel hero who is a symbol of all causes where somebody who is oppressed rises up against somebody who is oppressing them.
It's really fascinating because I think prior to research on this episode, I was like, Guy Fawkes is like the symbol of rebellion, and he's Guy Fawkes who did a rebellion. That's a really obvious link. And then when you actually look into it, you're like, first of all, he wasn't even the brains behind rebellion,
No.
he was the muscle. And second of all, he wasn't anti-establishment or anti, I don't know, authoritarian. He was anti-Protestant.
Yes,
Like,
and anti-Scottish.
yeah, and anti-Scottish. So, and I very much understand the choice of using Guy Fawkes because he's a long dead, and like you mentioned, very much folklorian figure now. Like, he's not a real person, Guy Fawkes. He's the made up Guy Fawkes from the stories written about him. But I do think that the Guy Fawkes from the 1600s would be traumatized to learn his face was being used. He'd be like, no, actually, a big fan on going to war and fighting and killing people. Big fan of that. Just only the people I want to kill.
It kind of reminds me of like people who have posters of like Stalin or Che Guevara and don't necessarily understand who those people were and what they actually did and the complexities and nuances of their actions. I feel like a lot of people are like, well, this is what happens. You know, it's an icon, it's an icon, it's an image, it's an ideal, but they don't actually know much about the person behind it. And as you say, they were rubbish at this. Like if you want a symbol of rebellion, shouldn't it be somebody who was good at rebellion and not somebody who just like announced to every random person who walked past that he was going to blow up the Houses of Parliament and had no plan and gave and like it, and t tried to tunnel through the Thames? Like they were so bad at this. I also think like Guy was this kind of outlier. A lot of the people who were involved in the plot were also members of the establishment. They were diff I'm not trying to undermine the oppression that they were going through as Catholics because it was horrible, but they were just trying to replace the establishment that had existed before with themselves. It was not a radical idea to try and change the way that the country worked and to try and get democracy. And, you know, it was just trying to replace one system of oppression with another. Their desire was to cause as much human suffering as possible, including amongst their own people. Rebellions are not often bloodless things. And I understand that sometimes in order to be able to fight back against people who are oppressing you, you have to turn to violent means and all sorts of things. But actually, funnily enough, the video with the Cockney cartoon rat had a very interesting point. I don't know if this actually happened, but they made up a conversation with the gang who were plotting, and one of them kind of said, "Does it not make us as bad as the people that we're trying to fight against if we knowingly try to kill our own people and children?" As collateral and accept that as collateral damage. Like, is this not making us as bad as the people that we're supposed to be fighting against? And so that little cartoon mouse or cartoon rat, whatever it was, actually made a good point. Like, I think I understand why his image has become so intertwined with revolutions. You know, you see the mask of his face at protests all over the world. People who can't possibly have any idea about what happened in England in 1605. It's just a symbol. And as I say, I understand that, but I just think that people haven't necessarily looked at what the values of that actual plot were and what the tactics were and why they were trying to do it and have. And so I always am kind of like, when they see them wearing these masks and things, I'm like, that's not really a great person to pick as your revolutionary idol. I don't know.
I know, it was like, it's like, I'm not going to get annoyed about it. Like, there are plenty of things in the world I'm annoyed about. I'm not going to get annoyed that
No,
people have
not at all.
decided to use a rich Yorkshireman from the 1600s as their face of rebellion. Like, you do that. But it funnily enough, very much brings me back to the whole sort of reason we started doing the podcast in the first place, which was we were both getting annoyed with people just say things that were wrong and no one was like correcting them because everyone, often the people you were listening to had, authority because they were, a reporter or, but they weren't British, or they weren't a reporter, or they were British, but, they, like, people just said things that were wrong and were like, that's wrong. That denied me. And it's one of those things where it's like, it's like a little bit of me every time I say something, I'm like, that's wrong. It's fine. I'm moving on. I will move, like, it's not going to bother me. I'm a long-term thing. And I, it's a nice mask. 10 out of 10. If you are going to be the fashion icon of 1605, you might as well get a mask made out of you. But I just like, oh, it's a very nice sort of circular thing that, like, the Guy Fawkes of today is the opinion I think the public has of him and we have of him is not the opinion of the real Guy Fawkes and the real gunpowder plot. And I think no matter what way you sort of look at the gunpowder plot, it does, it's not the same as how you've it's viewed today, no matter whether you think it's a good or a bad thing or
Your symbol is somebody who held his own considerable bigotries. He was just a guy who has become more famous than the actual guys who should be famous. I just realized I said he's just a guy.
a guy. Yes, he's just a guy. That's it. That's the message.
There's so many puns that we haven't even. We were so mature in this episode for not doing more puns.
Is all we have got for this week. If you happen to be near any bonfires in the next few days, feel free to remember the 5th of November.
November.
I mean, hopefully by the time this episode will have aired, some things will have happened that we can talk about from, the modern era. But we should be back next week, whether we're talking about recent things or things from hundreds of years ago,
Yeah.
no one knows.
Let's see how far back we can go. Bye
Surprise to everyone. But until then, it is goodbye from me.
and goodbye from me.